This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome everybody to the Global Leadership Platform, Multiplying Leaders, Moving Society. I am Kevin Farquharson. With me is the old man from Leadership Platform, Louis Groenewald.
Hi, Kevin. Look forward to today's session once again.
Yes, we are looking forward to today's session. It's our regular Professor Theo Veldsmann. For all things leadership, go to our website, www.leadershipplatform.com. Once again, Professor Theo Veldsmann, we love having you on the show. We love your insight, your experiences, your articles. So thank you for once again being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, and hello to the listeners as well. Today's theme is about organizations that leaders have to lead, because after all, that's what leadership is all about. You either a portion of organization or total organization. And we know that organizational design, the way you put the organization together, has a crucial impact on firstly how you actually unlocked value for your clients, for employees, for stakeholders, relative to the strategy you're pursuing. It's been proven without any doubt that your design, the delivery logic that you conceive for how you want to deliver that logic, is probably the most critical element in executing your strategy. Also in creating memorable experiences for your customers and your employees, such that you retain them and they don't leave you.
Theo, can I just contribute here? I want the listeners to appreciate where we come from. And Theo's case, being the resident, really world-class thinker on this subject. In our case, our leadership platform was interviewed and conversations with probably more top executives and thought leaders than anybody else. But in the process, our approach has often been on a personal basis. To us, leadership becomes intensely personal. So when we discuss the subject with Prof. Theo, we should not underestimate the need of the overall strategy he's speaking about and the impact it has on the individual. The question I always ask Theo in any kind of conversation, what is the impact on the individual? Because ultimately, it's the individual leader and the individual member of the organization that makes things work in a positive manner. And therefore, the discussion is a vibrant one we're having today. And now when Theo mentioned the concept of design, people, we design all the time. So what I'm saying is, if you don't do it consciously and deliberately, then you are designing something else. And that something else could be on the way to failure if you don't know what you are designing. All the actions we have as leaders, we're effectively putting forth some kind of plan. Sometimes the design is a daily one. Not so, Theo. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. Theo is speaking of with vast experience from the overall context that's needed so badly if you want to design a successful organization. Please go ahead, Theo.
Yes, Louis, building on what you said, you know, the nice metaphor to use here is that organizational design is like architecting the design of your house. You have to decide the shape of the house, the size of the house, the rooms you need to have in the house, because that in the end will ultimately determine the type of people you need to have to staff up the house with and how they're going to live together. There's evidence, very robust research, that's shown that where organizations are correctly designed, the house is right for the job it needs to do. We talk about fit-for-purpose organizations, that those organizations, based on the research, outperform by a multiple factor organizations that are incorrectly designed. In some cases, even there are case studies of organizations that have been the downfall, that they've had incorrect design.
The point is exactly that, Theo. I just want to emphasize the point. Theo's not just speaking of design. Now, you know, many people can design based on your background experience. He's speaking of a design for the organization of the future. Now, we've had thousands of discussions in this world of ours about the nature of the future. And this is exactly the very important dynamic point that makes this discussion different. It's about this different future. Not so, Theo?
Yes, very much so. In terms of, you know, a kind of a test of when you have a fit for purpose design is, firstly, does it fit the context in which the organization has to operate? If it's a stable type of context where you can predict where things are going, you need one kind of design, more a stable, more a formalized, standardized, we do things in a very prescribed manner, compared to a very turbulent context where you need a very nimble organization that can adapt all the time virtually on the spur of the moment. It's like an athlete that runs a certain race. It's preset. It's 1,000 meters you're going to run, and there's the track, compared to a volleyball kind of environment where the ball comes across the net and you have to immediately play it. So first thing is, does my design fit the context? The second one, does it translate my strategy into the way I want to work in the organization and make it happen? I mean, if you want to be a customer-centric organization, that's your strategy, you can't only focus on internal efficiencies. If that's your design, you have to have what we call an outside-in design. We start with the customer needs and you decide how you're going to satisfy them in a way that you exceeds all of the expectations. The third one is, of course, a design determines how resources are allocated in an organization and how easily the resources can move around. You can waste a lot of resources if your design is not fit for purpose. It brings everybody together. It brings the people, the culture, the systems, leadership into as a coherent whole. Because after all, organization is like a living system. The one part affects the other. And another important one is in terms of a fit for purpose design is, does it build and nurture your in-depth core capabilities? If you're a technology-driven organization, does it protect your core technologies? Does it build the skills that you need in order to deploy that technology successfully?
Theo, this morning I had a discussion with somebody who expresses a passionate feel about some ways to tackle a specific situation, and it bears out the point. This environment that this organization is moving into is very vibrant and changing all the time. And I know the CEO is very cautious of not making mistakes. You know, this person is dynamic and they very wants to be supportive, but they don't understand the need to adapt to the specific environment. You know, so the ideas are fine. They stand on their own feet. But when you put it in the context, and this is where you speak of the, does it fit the strategic market needs? Or does it fit the resources as well? And that's got to be considered very carefully. So in this case, it's not that it's a bad idea that this person came up with, but it doesn't fit the whole, you know, the strategic purpose of the organization at that time.
Yeah, this also goes to talking about what we discussed a few weeks ago about the myths of transition. And when a new leader comes in, this is almost like a blueprint. Hey, before you go in there and bring your bright ideas and get excited and all the rest, you need to weigh up whether what your new ideas are actually meeting what the company is already in. Because if you don't feel that way, you're going to disrupt whatever they have. So if the company is down and out and in the ditch, yes, then you would need that. But you have to be careful. You have to be careful about what was the original strategies and all the rest, their own future planning, and incorporate it with the new ideas where you feel change needs to happen, and not go in there like a bull in a china shop.
Can I put it this way? Let's continue with the analogy of the house. You buy a new house. That's like a CEO taking over a company. The house has got these different rooms. People live in a certain way in the house. Now you charge in there, to use your words, Kevin, like a bull in a china shop, and immediately you start with renovations on the house. I mean, you've got a separate lounge and dining room. Immediately you knock out the walls and create an open space. Meanwhile, you didn't try and work out and first find out why are they separate rooms positioned in a certain way relative to one another. And then, because remember, the design gives you this a certain logic of delivery. You are disrupting the logic without understanding why the logic is in place. Of course, if the company's bleeding at this stage horribly, you would try and stem the bleeding. But it's kind of doing an emergency job until you take control of the situation such that you can now come up and understand the, what's going wrong in the delivery logic. I mean, if your response is very slow to your client, if they put in an order, if you don't understand the market in terms of the products that you have to deliver and the quality, then you can start making changes to the house in terms of the delivery and the layout of the house.
It's quite frightening, though, Theo, in practice, what we come across, because there's no attention paid given to real strategic design. The people suddenly discover they need a second floor. You know, that means the whole structure has got to change. And then, you know, you just kind of fix here and fix there. And that happens because of the lack of vision in the beginning. So you add 2 points here, Theo. It says when we do these things, it directs and shapes efforts and performance in the appropriate direction. This is a case of channeling resources. Boy, is this important in practice. And then you speak high retention of customers and employees. Again, that's ultimately surely the justification for a good business.
Can I give you an illustration here? If you've got a functional design, you know, it's operations, it's or manufacturing, marketing and finance. Typically what happens in that type of organization, the people's focus is, in terms of the delivery logic, is to see to whether, to what extent they can maximize the effort and the performance of their function. They forget the bigger picture in order to get ahead in the game of their own function's performance. Take now that same very organization and you change the design, the logic of delivery to a focused delivery or a client delivery. In other words, you separate out what markets are we serving. There could be different markets with different products and services. Immediately, you turn the face of the people in terms of delivery logic to the market away from the functions. The functions are now in support of the markets or the clients you want to serve.
That's so critical. Thanks, Theo. Well, on this basis, I think Theo now will move to the next discussion, which adds a great deal of substance to discussion. Why has organizational design become critical? Theo, please expand on that.
Because the world is changing, Kevin and Louis, and I want to lift out four forces of this changing world. The one is, and we've discussed it before in this program, the VUCA's world. It's an adaptation expansion of the well-known VUCA world of increasing variety, interdependency or interconnectivity, complexity, change, ambiguity and seamlessness. The world has just become hyper-turbulent, hyper-fluid, changing all the time. And what we're seeing is the increase in the frequency of what people have called chaotic context of unknownables. We don't know what we don't know. In some cases, we know the unknowns, but we're not sure how they will change. So the first one is the dynamics of the world has just changed. Now, you can already start asking the question, in this kind of world, can I still have a kind of a bureaucratic, very standardized, very formalized organization if the playing field is changing all the time? The second one is the whole thing, and it's been encapsulated in the term the fourth industrial revolution. Exponentially accelerating technological innovation. And I have kind of, for me to make sense of it, come up with the acronym DIVAS. DIVAS stands for, first, every digitization, everything going onto computer and making a computer readable and processable. Digitization, first D of DIVAS. Second one, interconnectivity. Everything, everyone is talking to everyone and everything. It's also the Internet of Things. The third one, virtualization. You're being in the cyberspace, so you're present, delivering on an ongoing basis, anything, anywhere, anytime, anyhow, for anyone. The fourth one is automation, the A in DIVAS, that things are now getting before done by computers, by decision-making algorithms with minimum human mediation. And the last one is smart, the S of DIVAS, is you generating data from everything. And you've got in this space machine learning, where there's data feedback onto the machine and it becomes smarter, or otherwise we have these decision-making algorithms that actually make the decisions. In so many spaces, the decision-making algorithms have just taken over. So that's the second force. The third one is the whole emphasis on sustainability, that where we have an impact, we must make the world a better for upcoming generations. So being a good corporate citizen. The last one is stakeholders. The stakeholders, your range of stakeholders that you have to deal with have just exploded. And also the power of the social media. I mean, you sit here in the southern part of South Africa, you want to take some action, like when Eskom applied for the World Bank loans for Medupi and Kusile. Next moment, there's a worldwide lobby group on social media against granting them a loan because of they're going to build fossil fire power stations and it does not fit the sustainability picture. So all of these things added together, what happens now is what organizations are forced to innovate all the time, because the mass of the new equation, the way I've put it, is you have to intelligently respond twice as fast, deliver twice as much, at twice the speed, at half the cost, within half the accepted product service lifespan, and doing all of the aforesaid on a continuous, sustainable basis, anywhere, anytime, anyhow, anyone, anything. That's the world. Now, what type of organization design you need in this kind of world to stay ahead of the game and have a competitive edge?
Theo, bring it back to reality. The truth is that massive, powerful organizations are going down very rapidly around us. Look at the cell phone companies who actually are confronted with the real core of these things. Most of us are not necessarily concerned with all these factors. The truth is, be very careful. It's the very fact that you think is not quite applicable that may cause you serious problems in the future. Look at quickly some of the dominant cell phone companies have just kind of disappeared off the scene. Not so, Theo, because they just couldn't keep up with all these factors as well. They may have a core quality people in technology, for instance, but on the leadership side, the overall vision, etc., that obviously must have been lacking because they just missed it. I remember years ago, I was a partner at a company that sold Wang office automation equipment. Theo, you're probably too young. But anyway, Wang dominated the world of word processing. In fact, Wang systems were 60% of the world's word processing equipment at that stage, completely dominant. But Wang didn't see the great PC revolution coming along. Well, neither did IBM at that time. And then suddenly, within a few short years, Wang was completely diminished and became a support organization as well. Because they didn't understand the changing nature of the environment. And it's one of many examples we can find locally around us. People just disappear.
Can I add to your example, Nokia? Height of its fame, it had 35% of the cell phone market worldwide. In places like India, 80% plus of the population had cell phones, Nokia phones. At that stage, and I actually personally read the interview with the CEO, I've forgotten his name, of Nokia at that stage, and I'm talking about 7-8 years back. It was published in The Time or The Economist. And Apple was about to launch its first iPhone, and they asked Nokia, now, this new phone that Apple is bringing onto the market, do you see any threat of that for you? Ach, no, said the CEO. I'm virtually quoting him here. It is a kind of elitist product. It's too expensive. It will only grab a small portion of the market, and we into mass kind of product, mass customization, it's no threat to us. Famous last words. Hey, as you know, Nokia sold off its cell phone business, is it about 2-3 years ago, to Microsoft. They're out of that market because smartphones have just taken over. Why? because I would think there's an element of that, of the design inside the of that failure of Nokia. They weren't in touch with the market. They weren't picking up the signals at the and that's what we call an outside in design. You have your feelers into the market, you pick up the signals, and the people at the right level, at that coalface level, bring those responses into the organization and say, here is a major shift. We have to respond to that to keep ahead of the market. And also important, your design can actually leverage you that you can jumpstart the market. And that's essentially what Apple did by bringing the iPhone onto the market. But their design allowed that. And maybe you know that. I think I've mentioned it before in this program. Apple does not believe in doing market research. They say, we will kind of look at the needs, and then we will produce the products in terms of our internal dynamics to actually beat the pants, so to speak, of the clients in terms of their expectations.
I remember, Theo, while the dangerous sounds were coming in the world from technological about the entrance of the PC, a very important customer told us, a group of management, he's very concerned about our product. He says, not keeping up. And how agitated some of us were. We became very emotional. How can you tell us we're the dominant factor in the world? Please, a bit of advice from an old man in this game regarding what Theo's saying to the executives, the CEOs out there. Your environment may not require all these dramatic changes we're speaking about, may not. But your ability to keep up intellectually, just to think, to have discussions with format or people like Professor Theo is imperative, because that'll trigger ideas and suddenly you'll see the relevance and suddenly realize how you're becoming obsolete without realizing it. Because that's a problem. You're driven by the mechanics or the functions of day-to-day, and you miss the indications, because that won't stand up in front of you, except if your mind prepares you for that. Isn't that so, Theo?
Yes. I mean, can I too give you two more examples of the implications? Because what all of these dynamics, these forces are forcing organizations, the lifespan of organizations come down. The kind of average is now 12 and a half years for organizations to exist in present forms, and then they have to transform them into new formats. The one is, look at what Amazon has done to retail. They first started with the book industry, book retail. They wiped essentially the book retail's industry off by going virtual on that. Netflix has done that to the streaming of movies. They're actually changing that whole landscape. In Australia, I've seen an article on Rio Tinto, that big mining company. They're now designing mines, they open cast, granted, that will be totally machine controlled. You will sit in a control room and the machines on the ground will be controlled. There'll be nobody in the pit, so to speak. The machines will be automated, and they'll do the mining.
You see, what increases the challenge in our environment, Theo, is because your point previously of the emergence of very powerful stakeholders. Now, for instance, a gold mine can't just come and say, we're changing over to automation, you know, for very many reasons. The truth is, though, that this is what the executive, the planning people must consider. Because you can't ignore the stakeholders. At the same time, you can't ignore the need for technological advance. Theo, you mentioned a term here, you put it very, very harshly, a resultant imperative of ongoing, relentless, destructive innovation and continual learning teaching. Now, that's a strong statement you're making, resultant imperative. Please let's expand on that.
Well, if everything has become hyper-fluid, hyper-turbulent, Louis and Kevin, what that forces organizations, if they want to stay ahead of the game, not only survive, survival is okay, you can do it for a period of time, but you actually want to thrive to get ahead of the game, is that you have to go into this mode of continuous, as you've put it, Louis, relentless destructive innovation. And it's not only in terms of your products and your services, but it's also the processes and the practices through which you deliver. It's the total package in your organization. So there is, to use that expression, there's no longer any area that you can't question. There are no longer any holy cows in terms of how you do things. So very strongly, that's why you have to imagine where you want to be with your company's 5 to 10 years in the future. You have to go and visit your company, so to speak, the future you want to create. And then you come back into the present and say, how do I have to reinvent the delivery of logic of my organization to be able to do exactly that? And that also implies nobody's got answers nowadays. It implies going with that destructive innovation. It implies ongoing learning, experimenting, trying out new things, and learning from it. And you see, but typically what companies do, they want to innovate, but they don't want to take the mistakes that come with that, the failures. And so they punish the people, they look for the scapegoats, and people don't innovate. You have to create an environment, a context in which people are willing to take risks, and you actually reward them for the fact what they're learning from the mistakes they make in order to improve the organization. I mean, that's what Chris Becker did at Media 24 when it was still NASPERS and the whole digital media world was emerging. Nobody knew where it was going. So he had a number of initiatives running in the company. They were kind of saying, I'm betting different horses here. And people failed, but they weren't punished for that. They said, okay, we've learned this is not the avenue to go. It's rather this avenue or that avenue.
Again, you see, when you speak that way, Theo, what I look at is the imperative of a changing mindset in the leaders, the top leader. Now, Theo also is a high-profile industrial psychologist, although he calls himself a work psychologist. So whatever he does is also viewed from the fact of how the individual sees and perceives things. Theo, just a little comment from you, if you don't mind, about how all this, all these great imperatives, how it impacts on the mindset of the individual leader.
You've touched on really the crucial thing. Can I maybe introduce another metaphor here? Louis, Kevin, if you still look at the world as if it's a flat world, you'll behave to a flat world. Hey, but if you convert, you have a mindset shift to seeing the world as a round world, round, then you're going to behave completely differently. You see, when and the mind shift that leaders have to undergo here is with respect to their organizational design relative to strategy, is if they still think design is about the organigram and drawing the boxes and the lines and who reports to who and the span of control, you in a flat world, you're going to be dead in the water. What you have to look at is, and a little bit of technical jargon, is the way we now look at organizations, the new mindset, the round world way, is to look at organizations as complex ecosystems. In other words, they pieces that fit together, that interact. And leaders have to have, and we also call that the big picture thing, of there's a strategy of the organization. How does it fit the design? How must I translate that into the design? How does that design impact the performance? What type of people do I need to populate this design with? If you've got a team-based type organization, you have to have team-type people in the organization. What type of leadership is right to lead this organization? What type of culture do I need, and how do we deploy resources in this organization? So you have to come up in this new world. We talk about seeing the organization as a living ecosystem from a complexity perspective. And the best analogy here again is the body. You've got a brain, you've got kidneys, you've got lungs. All of these things have to work together to give you a good way of living and to be able to do things. You can't just concentrate on the brain. Sometimes that's what leaders do. They look at the strategy and say, oh, we got to find strategy. People go and do it. And meanwhile, the design, the house, does not support the execution of that strategy at all.
So there's something very foundational that we're discussing as well. You know, on the one hand, when you're exposed to the strategic thinking of a Theo Veldsmann with respect, Theo, it can be very disrupting. It can be painful in many ways. The truth, though, is, speaking from a lot of experience also, we're not speaking of a perfect leader. We're not speaking of arrogance. We're not speaking of a person that of necessity must always be able to give the answers. We speak of something far more significant. It's a certain mindset of growth and change, and all these various pointers mentioned by Theo helps us understand that it's pretty exciting, the kind of person you need. And the last thing an organization nowadays needs is an arrogant know-it-all leader, that everything must be done exactly the way they say. If you want to lose confidence, go ahead and cultivate that old-fashioned idea. At the same time, there's a authentic strength that kind of flows from a person who's got this mindset. You feel it when you see them. When we interview them too, you know, Theo, within a minute you feel that vibe of that person. And that's not a vibe of I know it all. It's a vibe of continually learning, adapting, and being able to make decisions based on all the guidelines that you're speaking about.
Yeah, and there's, can I add to that, there's a humbleness, eh? And an eagerness to learn and to experiment. And you see the a typical wrong response that I see from a lot of organizations under these turbulent, hyperfluid situations, which is exactly the wrong response, Louis and Kevin, and that is, things seem to be out of control. We need another standard here. We need another methodology. I mean, take our minds, the concern about safety on our minds. We're killing too many people, and it is really sad that we're doing this, but we introduce another procedure. We introduce another standard. We introduce another check. We start over-controlling the situation in a very dynamic situation instead of moving back and giving people the capacity through enabling, empowering them to take charge of their own situations. But we want to take charge of the situation so that we actually become like the leaders, like the big puppet master pulling the strings of the puppets. Instead of letting the puppets go and make their own decisions, but informed way through us enabling, mentoring, coaching, in empowering them.
Theo, I've worked closely. I still am, you know, in my old age, involved in coaching a team in a very dangerous environment, and they're doing great. But partly because they recognize the danger and they're very safety. It's a gold mining industry. They're very safety conscious, extremely so. But what this team has managed to do is instead of reacting exactly the way that you're warning, that you start laying down controlling things, because by implication, when you do that, you create a sense that they don't really trust you, you know, yeah. And therefore you feel it. You can feel the vibes in the bosses as well. Now that can generate mistakes. That can generate the fatalities, make no mistake. On the other hand, as they develop this kind of confident, trustful environment of really looking carefully at every regulation, auditing it all the time, but there's a team spirit there. And you get a feeling that the chances of serious accident happening is greatly lessened because of that. It's a leadership mindset. It really is.
If you don't have that aha experience in this new context, this new world, from going from a flat world to a round world, you're in serious trouble. Because you can't try and deal with a round world if you still have a flat world mindset, Louis.
The real challenge is the implications of these things. The, you know, the what you trigger. For instance, if you have this tense sense of things must be done in a specific way and control it rigidly, you really evoke a climate. It's the opposite of a passionate climate where people are contributing, feeling part of it. Even this beautiful sense of humor, which you find with people that are confident that what they're doing is right, very serious, and then I love it to see that. And when that sense of humor, of enjoyment is lacking, then you look for the dangerous signs that, boy, it's a case of somebody wants to have rigid control because very concerned about some stats. And then by that, and by doing that, they actually are really damaging the real purpose of the organization.
if I could just come in here and disagree with everything you've said. And I was thinking as we're going along that the new millennials hop around from one job to another. And one of the reasons, in my opinion, is one of the positives of that is they always bring new ideas, new thoughts, new perspectives. I have a 24-year-old son, and if you want to know anything about technology, hire a teenager. They somehow have this amazing ability to grab an electronic device and sort out whatever your problem is, that those of us who are over 40 plus, 50 plus, we get it right if we put our minds to it, but it takes us so much longer. We had an experience even here at Leadership Platform with one of our recording devices, and this young man just took over, and in minutes he did something that I didn't know how to do. I was too scared to even approach it. So having that fresh ideas and just like you're saying, having this no more blinkers, no more arrogancy, as Louis was saying, it just does not work for the future.
You see, interesting here, Kevin. Have you ever observed, and I try to contrast myself also against my kids, and our son in particular is very good technology savvy, is we've been brought up in a world that's stable. So if you look, approach technology, it's like step one, step two, follow the manual, yes, and then the thing should work.
Yes.
Technology's become so open-ended. There are multiple permutations and options and functionalities. If they engage with a piece of technology, I've observed our son, he experiments. He hasn't got the answer. He tries this. Does it work? No, it doesn't work. Then I have to try this, etc. And kind of while he's doing it, he's eliminating possibility. And the next moment, the thing is working.
Yes.
There's no manual in sight, hey?
Absolutely.
It's engaging directly with the technology, but with an open mind, experimenting, innovating kind of approach.
And for those of us who are older, that scares us. And looking at CEOs and leaders who are older, that scares us because there isn't a step one to step 10, and by step 10, it's all done. It's no longer like that, and it's scary.
To sound a warning voice from the point of view of these older guys, why they're scared of the changes. That, obviously, I'm a person that has got a passion for innovation, and new ideas, etc., and my life's been spent investing that one. But at the same time, I have great understanding for instance, somebody comes along with a zestful new idea, etc. But again, if you don't have the approach that Theo was saying, the total approach to the total design, then that's going to threaten you. But you won't know what it's threatening. If you don't understand the full picture, that the total context, Theo, that you are speaking about today, then those ideas could well be threatening, be dangerous.
A colleague of mine had the experience with one of the major banks. They wanted to become more innovative. So they approached them, and these are also work psychologists. They said, can you generate a profile of the innovative type of employee? Fine, they generated the profile. We liked the profile. Then they said, go and find those people for us. And I'm not sure about the number. So it was kind of 20 of these innovative people they had to go and recruit from there, which they did. After about 4 months, they get this desperate call from this bank, come and take these people away. They're causing havoc. They're not paying any attention to instructions, to authority. They don't abide by our policies, whatever. It's just disaster time. You see, what they did not do, they wanted more innovation, but they did not want to change the house in which the kids, these new innovative employees, had to live to make a difference. So they kicked them out of the house.
Theo, that's why I speak of the warning voice. You can't really replace with respect, the maturity of a good leader. Theo, let's move to the design criteria. Now, how do we go about designing this kind of organization?
What we've now discussed, if you want to have the organization of the future, change your mindset to the seeing the organization as this complex ecosystem and look at all the pieces. The second one is like when you approach an architect to build a house, you give the architect a number of specifications, you know, this size house, two garages, north facing, whatever. When you think you want to engage with designing your organization with the future, you must have agreement on the design criteria, the specs according to which you want to build this the organization, and it must be able to deliver. And I want to raise 10 criteria that's become critical for the organization of the future. Firstly, the organization must be designed around its purpose and the meaning it wants to create. In other words, what difference does it want to make as an organization in the space in which it operates, the community it's embedded, it is the stakeholders it wants to serve. Immediately, your organization becomes purpose and meaningful driven, because that is the basis. Next around, the next criterion is the whole issue of how will you get people technology optimization. How do you bring the people and the technology together in such that you can really get a great results from that? That's the second criteria. The third one is, what are the core capabilities that you have to build in the organization in order to compete? Maybe it's customer relationships. Maybe it's a certain technology. Maybe it's a certain type of process. Maybe it's the brand that you want to. That's the next criteria. The next one is collaboration. The organization of the future is built on collaboration within the organization through teams, and we'll get to that, and with stakeholders and partners. You can't do the job any longer by yourself. The next criterion, and what's that? That would be number 1, 2, 3, 4. The fifth one is outside in. What kind of memorable experiences do I have to create for my customers, my stakeholders? What is that? How will I delight them? And I have to have clarity on that, because that's going to affect the way in which I design the organization. Then a number of important qualities, also part of the DNA, the criteria. Agility, the ability to move fast and quick. The next one is autonomy. You have to empower people down to the bottom level to make decisions.
On the autonomy, the freedom to take decisions where action happens. Again, this is dependent, though, on the overall confidence in the strategy that you approach. Otherwise, you as a leader or leaders must have a confidence that you're building a structure that you can and should allow autonomy to apply. If you don't know what you're doing with respect, if your vision isn't clear, if all the other elements that Theo's speaking about is not put in place, then you will not be able to provide that autonomy.
And can I tie to that in terms of that autonomy, Louis? And that is why if you go to the receptionist, if you go to the plant operator, if you go to the security guy at your firm, and you ask them at that level, what is the strategy of the company and how does it pan out in your situation? And that person can't say, for me as a security guy, this is what customer centricity looks like. As a receptionist, this is what. For a plant operator, you have not been successful in cascading your strategy and translating it into the necessary actions into the organization. Then you can't give people autonomy because they don't know what to do.
Asking that question at that level does indicate, though, a basic confidence you have or a passion to make sure everybody feels in principle the same. Don't expect them to understand your overall strategy, but do expect them to understand the core vision. If not, then you're asking for trouble. Yes.
And Kevin and Louis, these very nicely CEO executive roadshows to go and share the strategy. You know, at the end of the 45 minutes of this very powerful PowerPoint presentation, dead silence in the room. Nobody asks the question. CEO is deadly unhappy. Why can't the people get excited and passionate about what we want to do? Firstly, you've thought about 5 months about this. You expect people to buy into this in 45 minutes. Secondly, it's at an organizational level. Until it hasn't been translated down to the plant operator, to the security guy, to the person working after the teller in the bank, that it makes it's meaningful and purposeful of them, you have not succeeded in rolling out your strategy.
I remember once years ago visiting, in the capacity of some leader, a hospital, an orthopedic hospital, and on the walls were some consultancy group had been called in, and they've got all these mission statements and, you know, the rights of everybody over there. And I get down to the actual wards, and the person can't call for help because the little button, that thing has been stolen. Example. No, but the point is that one can understand. But what happens is these great strategy statements become demotivational. Because when I spoke to the sister concerned, she didn't have a good a healthy idea or respect for what these people are trying to tell them. They weren't getting down to her. So therefore, your point is very valid to make sure that your months of work is communicated in some way down to everybody organization. That also, by the way, will mean that you're not afraid. In fact, you're keen to speak to everybody down there. Your line of sight is much more acute and effective than would be the case of sending things to the top and then accepting the fact that it's going to arrive at the bottom. They won't arrive at the bottom by themselves.
Yeah. If I may share the last two criteria out of the 10, the one is resilience. You have to, because everything is changing, you have to build the ability into the organization to bounce back. You can call also a level of high reliability in the organization if something goes wrong or there's an opportunity. Because interesting, the latest thinking around resilience, in the past, resilience was seen as bouncing back after a disaster or a crisis. Now people are saying what we have to build in our organization is proactive resilience so that if an opportunity comes up, we can respond to that. And I think we understand, and personally I would include myself there, little about this proactive resilience. And the last one, which even intrigues me, is that the design criteria of stability in spite of the change. And what it says, and there's research to demonstrate this, I mean, you can go into a total state of chaos, continuous innovation and agility, and you're changing things all the time, etc., is you have to be certain in your organization what are the stable things that will guide you through the hyper turbulence and the hyper fluidity. And what it boils to down, Louis and Kevin, is you have to be clear what you are as an organization, what you stand for, what's acceptable, unacceptable, what your aspirations are, and broadly speaking, how you're going to get there. That's kind of your anchor. And some people have summarized that as to be clear on the identity of your organization. Around that and the value proposition of what you want to deliver to your clients, in between, everything can be questioned. Everything can be innovated. But have those two firm anchors in your world.
I love and respect so highly, Theo, the point you mentioned about the stability. Everybody has a basic need for certainty and stability as well. But traditionally, we focus it on certain things, like certain income levels, securing your job, everything is the same as before. And what we're saying is, people, that kind of stability really doesn't last. But another kind of stability that grows out of cultivating this kind of culture that the prophet is speaking about is so important. It has to do with those basic needs being satisfied in a person. So therefore, if you go into this organization, you don't expect things to be the same. Your stability and your security will come from a sense that we are tied in with a goal, a mission, and that's what drives us. And amazing how difference it makes to one's sense of, quite frankly, of happiness and innovation and courage and sense of humor and all the things that really matter most in life. So I respect that highly. It seems just another point, stability doesn't. The constancy in identity while changing things around you. So there must be a constancy in life. And that's why the overall strategy and vision in terms of planning this, Theo, is so important.
The psychological term that gets used to what you've explained here is what we call an internal locus of control. You find your security in your own identity, and that gives you the stability similar to organizations. What do we stand for? What do we want to achieve? What's the legacy we want to leave behind here? And what are we aspiring to? That gives you the secure anchor. Also, what value do we want to produce? That's a secure anchor. And then, as I said, I'm repeating myself here, in between, everything can be questioned, everything can be changed. But those are your secure anchors in this world.
Your statement, from command and control to high agile, high engagement, high networking organizational shape. In other words, where we command and control. There are any people, don't underestimate, this is really the way to have command and control. But a traditional way of command and control, like a military officer at the top, is where it really can corrupt this whole thing. So therefore, if you want to have command and control, because quite frankly, Theo, if you apply this, you're getting real command and control in the sense that matters.
That's a paradox, Louis, what you're describing. We think by taking more charge of the organization, command and control, we're actually getting less, because everything now centers around us and it becomes impossible to lead and direct the organization appropriately. So, I mean, we've got a journey here. We said, change your mindset in this new world if you want to set up a future fit organization for the future. Secondly, we've specified the design criteria. And the third one is now you have to kind of build a house. And I want to kind of take a little bit of a history. In the past, and a lot of organizations are still like that, and the analogy here is of a pyramid, CEO at the top and control and everybody looking upward in the hierarchy, please instruct us what to do. I mean, the other example you can use here is a massive oil tanker, captain on bridge, all the instructions emanate from the bridge and I just passive, etc. Then an interesting shift, and there's a retailer in South Africa that's done this, is what they've done, they talk about the inverted pyramid. And what they say is, we at the higher levels, where's the action? The action is where the customer is. Who are then the people that we have to empower, enable, are the people that serve the customers. So the rest of the organization, from the CEO, executives, middle management, supervisors, are there to support the people that have to serve the customers at the front line. So you're turning the pyramid upside down. I mean, Jack Welch already made this point. He says, you know, how we've designed organizations is people look up the hierarchy with their backsides to the customers. With the inverted pyramid, we turn it around. We now supporting the people that are in contact with the customers that we've empowered to actually serve them. The third important emergence now is beyond the pyramid, and that's that high engagement, high agile, high networking organization, building organizations around teams to serve, and teams would serve customers. They would have ownership of a total process, etc. Your whole organization becomes team-based. Smaller business units, teams, typically what the research has shown, not more than 10, 12 people around. And you can have a number of teams around the core value chain of the organization referenced against the value proposition of serving a customer that actually does certain things. Some teams are developing product innovation. Some are in the process of serving the client. Some are involved in making sure that the client are delighted in terms of the experience interfacing or interacting with you. So a shift from pyramid. Next possibility is to flip that pyramid around, and then you're facing towards the customer. Third one is completely rethinking your organization in terms of teams. And the teams are actually the means of delivery.
Theo, we are getting back to my point at the beginning. A leader who's serious about manifesting this kind of culture needs to consider seriously and have somebody like a Prof. Theo around to guide. That's what he does. Perhaps you can just touch briefly what you consider some tangible characteristics of the leadership capabilities that you'd be looking for in this kind of culture.
Yeah, this type of organization, you now have to design this organization. You have to ensure that the people that are going to live in this house is going to live in a a way that you can actually create great value. I think there are a number of these characteristics. First, Louis Kevin, shared leadership. It's no longer the CEO at the top. It is actually shared leadership and leadership at all levels in all areas. It's the second one is leadership that's future-centric. You're facing the future all the time. Yes, you have to deal with crises in the present, but you deal with them with reference to where you want to be in the future. Some crises, in a sense, could become irrelevant if you realize where you want to take the organization. I mean, if there's a drop-off in a certain area of the organization with product sales, and you know where you want to land them in the future, and that area is irrelevant, then you don't deal with that crisis. You kind of gracefully exit. The third one is you must become purpose and meaning driven. The term that gets used for that is spiritual leadership. Infuse the whole organization with purpose and meaning. And Kevin, you spoke about the millennials. It is a primary thing for them to ask the why am I doing this? You know, we want to be first choice in our industry, make the most money. Then they ask, why? Is it only to enrich the stakeholder shareholders? Why? What is the purpose beyond being first in your industry? The next quality of the leadership is servanthood. I'm here to serve. I'm not here to promote my own self-interest. Stewardship, I'm here to look after the resources. That's part of the sustainability that's entrusted to me. Coaching, enabling, empowering, working in a teaming fashion, which ties into shared leadership, a caring type of leadership style, caring for your people, and finally being constantly creative, inquisitive, questioning. Those are some of the key qualities for me, Louis Kevin.
We advise strongly that you look at your whole culture and organization, think of the things said here, and then get people, a person like Prof. Theo in to discuss it. He also provides then some stress tests, which we can't discuss now. In other words, that you can test, you can audit whether you have a fit for purpose organization design. But remember, ultimately, it's a very personal thing, how you see your organization and how your organization adapts to your vision. Theo, thank you very much. It's been a great discussion. Once again, my own concern is we're fitting in a whole kind of a quarterly of a year chapter in this one discussion, and it deserves far more than that. Theo, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for the privilege of having me.
Thank you, everybody. That was Professor Theo H. Veltzmann, our regular on the Leadership Platform show, which we really, really appreciate your time and effort you put into the articles and what you share with us. Thank you so much, Theo. And that is our Global Leadership Platform for today. Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.